And sometimes our life is actually kind of stop and start.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon, Maggie?
I said, what did I say? I can't remember, Michael.
Well, I heard the word wonderful. I don't know what you were framing it as.
Oh, yeah, about instant teleseminar. That's
yes.
A really cool feature, yeah, to
yeah.
Stop it. And
I hate to tell you this, Michael, but the one you just sent me was the first four again.
Oh, no.
Not the 5 through 9 that you sent that I lost. That's all right. Let's keep going here. I can.
Would you like for me to forward it to you?
Yeah, anyone can. I don't care. It'd be great.
Okay. Yeah, well, you probably have Bert's email and your address, so thank you.
You're welcome. No problem.
There you go. So it's on the way.
I did have a whole bunch of really fascinating comments. I re-listened to the hour and a half of session 4, which
yes.
is kind of an interesting different session, and I wanted to. And I was listening to it as a recording, and I kept wanting to come in and say something, you know, but it was a recording, you know, and so I was going, damn. So I was writing this stuff down, and I wanted to say that while the session was going on, I think you did all the questioning with BJ. Is that correct?
With BJ, yes.
Well, what I found myself was not only observing, but also participating, too. And it was a very interesting situation. Stuff would come to me, and then I would get back to awareness of what she was saying and so on and so forth. And yet I was sort of going through it at the same time. I thought it was really interesting.
What that phenomenon, I know, and I labeled it on the call Ricochet Coaching, but that phenomenon is actually the principle behind group coaching. See, there's an assumption in coaching that coaching happens one-to-one. And when there's only one person on the phone, that's true. But in much the same way in any presentation, when you're working with somebody, there's going to be a ripple effect, a resonance with people in the room. And if you set up a group coaching scenario where you have 5 to 6 people on the call and you go ahead to coach one of them, because synergistically everybody is connected, everybody's going to get pinged to one degree or another. And especially if they engage with the process along the way. So if they use the prompt of the coaching to ask themselves in a group coaching setup, regardless of who the kind of proxy server is for the whole room, you know, the focal point, it can go through everybody and transmit into anybody who's in on the call, contingent on the degree of application, as well as the recognition that, you know, there's an intention to develop, advance, grow, evolve, whatever the word is for people. And so it is something that when you go ahead and do group coachings, it's one of the benefits. People may think, well, geez, the coaching is only 90 minutes and I'm one of 6 people, which means I'm only going to get 15 minutes coaching. No, actually not. If they really work it right, they'll get 90 minutes.
Yeah, I have a new expression for that as it related to me. It's not only pinging, but it's ponging, so it's ping pong.
How wonderful.
Did you get the email, Bert?
I did not.
You did not?
No.
You should have, unless I...
Wow. Bert has become the Bermuda Triangle.
You're not meant to get these slides, Bert.
Sorry.
Not right now, clearly.
Later.
Yeah. Not right now, apparently. So, as you know, always for people who in other sessions, I have planned to speak things that are on the slide so that people can get a sense of it and participate. The questions that are on the pulse check slide today are, what passion has been released or connected with? How is passion affecting your life? And what part does passion play in your work with your clients? So whichever of those questions resonated with you, you know, and know that they're in the recording so that you can go back and pick the other ones up later, what one hit you first?
Well, this is Margie. The one that hits mm-hmm. me first is the third one. What part mm-hmm. does passion play in your work with your clients? And probably the answer to that is I'm doing exactly what I'm passionate about doing with my work with mm-hmm. my clients.
Okay, so you're doing what you're doing, but how does passion support, create, interact, stretch, you know, how does it play in that work?
I think I guess I'm sort of getting stuck with the word play because I have a feeling I'm not going in that play direction at the moment.
Well, how does it play out? How does it show itself?
Well, today's a good example. I had a discovery session with a lady this afternoon who we were talking about contracts that she has, and I realized that I totally got into, you know, what just some tips for her around how she can really take advantage of moving into a contract type of situation with these companies that she's doing work for without. So my passion really came out around, you know, how she can really take the role of a successful businesswoman as opposed to someone who's almost becoming a victim because these companies realize they've got a really good thing, paying her hardly anything, and they have no commitment.
Mm. So all of a sudden your passion translated into advocacy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah. And that is one of the powers of passion in what it is that we engage with our clients, is that we will tend to stand for things that we see as valuable. And we will advocate for them.
The way I...
Especially because... Yes, go ahead, Bert.
Well, the way I interpreted your word passion and work is, the way I deal with it is, what's their passion about their work, and the passion of the people around the owners and so forth to even be in the room. And so I've been trying to blend in some of your stuff. I'm actually going into a strategic planning session, and one part of strategic planning is, what's the passion of the group?
Mm.
What's
Great
the life
question.
Passion of the group? You know, why are you guys playing together? That's a question that I ask. But in terms of figuring out their plan, I wrote down something from your stuff, and that is, I'm wondering if I can work with a group so they can sense the future plan supported by all the evidence, or even if some of the evidence may not be supportive of a preconceived plan, getting them out of preconceived ideas and so forth and see if they can actually sense a future plan.
Right. Nice.
So, it's a whole stretch.
It is a stretch. And so you've got them stretching in two places. You've got them stretching internally by having them look at, you know, what is it, what's their collective passion for? Meaning, why are you playing together?
Right.
And then, where is this passion taking you? And as one is connected to that, one can start to feel the future coming toward you. And you can go, oh, yeah. I now see this. Instead, I would have been looking through the lens of my intellect. I would not have been connecting with the passion about what it is. And your passion can open up the vision that you receive.
Yeah, I'm fully into that. I'm still trying to, work that into the way I deal with people, because I really like that. That came out of the last thing about sensing the future and so forth, and I'm wondering whether or not I can't work that in this coming week.
That'll be interesting. But what in this, what I hear is in your background, the intersection of two passions in particular. One is a passion for learning, blended with the passion for service to your clients. You want to take them as far as they can possibly be taken, and so in order to do that, you keep learning so that you can keep taking them further than you took the last one.
That's all true.
So it means that your passion for those two things together is a really wonderful synergy that keeps you yourself moving forward. And that, going back to what you were talking about, Margie, your passion for that stuff that became the advocacy is also part of your learning that keeps taking you forward.
Mm.
Our passion takes us forward. And it's not one about smashing through obstacles. It's because it is part of the fire that's burning inside us for the world or the universe or the people that we engage with, to have a better experience. And we see a particular path of passion. Whether that passion be expressed through the mechanics of business, whether it be expressed through leveraging uniqueness, whether it be expressed through focusing on personal development, it doesn't matter. It's all about the ultimate and optimal evolution of each person you engage with. And so in this case, all of our passion, and from that old maxim, all roads lead to Rome, yes, it does. They all lead to that same place. Who else? What other question pinged you out of those three? What passion has been released or connected with? How is passion affecting your life? Or what part does passion play in your work with your client?
Well, this is BJ, and since I was the focal point of the Ricochet coaching last week around passion. What I've noticed coming up, and I was with your question more of, just notice what might show up and what might need to shift. Mm-hmm. So what I'm noticing showing up is being fully passionate about my own life in all of its aspects. And as I have that, so I was talking about like being 80%, it's like, wow, if I have that 100%, so I'm really, like, my life is full and I have energy about it all, that's like my calling card. And so that's where I'm being right now. And I'm already getting feedback from people like, wow, you're showing up differently and or more, more solid, solidly grounded. And what I'm finding is, this has been going on for a while, and what I noticed this week is showing up is easier, being connected with other people with an ease. And so there's almost that passion that I'm not sure it's as much about fire as it is joy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I hear that part of what you may be engaging with is the fuel of what one might call work, ultimately plays around.
Mm-hmm.
Which is having a passionate life.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And so
Yes.
If one is to have a passionate life, if one is to be an advocate or a champion for a passionate life, then wouldn't it seem to make sense that one of the places where one has to focus is to have a passionate life themselves?
Exactly.
Not yes, not so much so that it is the, you know, like a walking the talk thing, but so that it is a laboratory wherein you explore what is going to confront other people when they engage.
Mm-hmm.
And also so that you model, not necessarily from the point of view of I'm going to model so that I can teach, but you simply presence.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, other people will engage with that as well.
Right.
Well, for all of us, our growth is directly related to, you know, as they say, the thing we need to learn has been historically part of something that has been absent in us, or at least our experience of it, to its fullest capacity. So to use myself as an example, my passion for leveraging uniqueness, and I've mentioned this before, goes back to the state of being and the pain that I experienced about the absolute lack of self-acceptance. And so if one hasn't been living a passionate life to the fullest degree, and that's been painful to some degree, guess what? That's part of the prompt. The life experiences that put one in an experience of not necessarily fully living a passionate life is part of educating you about what the price is. In the same way that for Margie, you know, historically, any of the times where anything has, you know, gone wrong in a business venture, or for Burton in a similar way, the desire to have, or the passion for other people to have clarity about how to function well in business, has come through a bunch of lessons that were painful. It's part of what its purpose is. All of that anguish that we felt, and I'm not talking about the struggle and the suffering, but the pain and anguish that we felt about certain circumstances in our life, is part of our education.
So, Michael, which brings us back to the place of really all of these questions bring us to the question of how is the passion affecting your life?
Yes.
Because whether we display them with our work and with our clients, or whether we look at them from a more internal perspective, it is all fully driven from that place.
Yep. And I would say it's less driven than it is called.
Yeah, I was thinking about that word.
Yes. You know, personally, I would prefer to be called rather than driven like an ox.
Yeah, I think it is more of a...
Oh, look, I'm a dull, brutish thing that needs to have a whip on my butt in order for me to move. I would rather be called, hey, come here. Doesn't it look great over here? Doesn't this look great? I would rather be called than driven. That's just personal. Cool. So anything you want to add to this whole thing, Molly?
Well, my middle initial is P, for passion. And you know me, I'm very passionate about what I really believe in, and I can't be any other way, and it works. You know, it's that energy that it creates. It's the change that it creates. It's the wanting to be with others that want that change. I think passion is wonderful, and it keeps me focused. Telling me where I want to go and what I want to do. And there are times when that passion can also be a deterrent because it means taking a risk that I might not ordinarily do, but I'm so headstrong and believe that I have to do it, that I will take the risk. And sometimes, you know, those risks can be challenging, but I'll still do it because I believe in it.
So what you're saying is that it's less of a passion. It's not so much that passion is a deterrent, but the fear of where your passion may take you can be a deterrent.
Yeah, yeah. The passion really isn't the deterrent. It's the outcome of it.
Yep.
Of what it can be. But it doesn't mean that I won't do it. Because
right.
My desire is so strong and intense.
Yes. Yep.
And I really believe, you know, I have to first accept me, as you said, you know. And this came from pain, by the way. This did not come, I didn't pull it down from the air. It definitely
right.
comes from pain because it's a learning experience. So when I clear out that stuff, those frictors, boy, does that passion present itself. It's
yes.
there, and it just
it
flows.
It's there.
Yeah. It
and
flows.
My son, who had a childhood as a young Finn asthmatic boy in a rural country town that praised toughness and, you know, contact sports, which meant he was ill-suited to participate in his small school. And so he also got bullied a bit, quite a bit, in school. You can imagine now what he might be interested in. And one of those things is that he has come across, you know, personal defense techniques, and he's passionate about spreading those so that other people don't go through the experience he did. And he's got a real fire in him about it. He loves it. He studies it. He loves it. He's even thought of becoming a sheriff so that he could, you know, protect people from that kind of behavior. But he feels that it's more valuable for him to teach people how to do it for themselves rather than wait for somebody to protect them. And that's there for all of us. And as you said, it comes out of pain.
So, Michael, your example strikes me as a passion that comes out of life experience rather than coming out of the cosmos.
Yes. Unless, of course, one wants to wonder about what put us on the path of that life experience in particular.
So that leads me to another thing that I wrote down all of the last week, and then that question right there. It seems like the questions that you come up with come from belief in universal intention.
Yes.
Okay.
They tend to come through me, and that it's part of something that's being served that I can't perceive at the moment.
Well, okay. By that I mean so that a certain passion is to be brought forth for each of us, as if there's a grand plan for passions.
Well, it's actually the certain passion brought forth for each of us is, at least in my frame, part of the expression of uniqueness. So what's going to really hone your expression except being put on a path wherein certain challenges are presented to you that are not necessarily presented to others, but they are presented to you according and you're also then equipped with certain strengths and talents and gifts and attuned to a certain methodology of being. And then those challenges being presented to you sort of forges you through the crucible of life into this fuller expression of what you can really be. So it's kind of like when you get an element, say silver, and then it goes through the expression, it goes through the forge, and it can come into all sorts of different shapes. But its essence is still silver, with the properties it still has. And so the circumstances forge it into the tool or piece of art or weapon or whatever it is that it is to be congruent with the nature of the element itself. And in this frame, the element is the element, let's see, BER 235 for Bert.
So Silver's journey is to discover that it's silver.
Yes.
And all the forging and everything is like our story or our environment or our changing conditions and all that other kind of stuff that are constantly bombarding us, preventing us from, on the one hand, they're, you're giving us examples that they're also part of the path, but on the other hand, they sort of thwart or get in the way of.
I wouldn't say they thwart. They actually give us a clarification of fit.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Because, you know, they are part of the shaping. The fact that silver can't do certain things is part of its elemental nature. You know?
Okay.
And that it can do other things. The fact that gold can do certain things and it can't do other things, etc. It's part of its nature. But how does that nature get expressed? By bumping up against things it can't do as part of it. That's, you know, a certain percentage of it. And then also gravitating toward things it can do, both of which in the process of what it can't do and what it can do, it crystallizes the clarity of what it is.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Great. Great observation and questions. So, let's fly. Saying what is. This is, well, let me ask you out there. And I put up the saying what is slide. The agility of that, where it says it has language that is clear, clean, timely, truthful, relevant, respectful, without judgment, from a place of ownership for what is being said, charge neutral in emotion, tone, and volume, has no hidden agenda, is absent of persuasion, unburdened by concepts, jargon, mysterious notions, or beliefs. Okay, so how does, from your experience out there with respect to your passions, how does saying what is as an agility enhance your ability to express and live from your passion?
Well, what I get is that it's about ownership. Like, this is mine, and it's not, I'm not concerned about what anybody else thinks about it or what their reaction is to it. And it's just, it's laying it out there sort of as, well, saying what is, it's just laying it out there as, this is me, this is who I am. And, it's part of that place we were talking about a little bit last week too. There's no place to get hooked.
Mm-hmm.
It's my truth.
Right. How else does it interact with people's passion? How does it interact with yours? The ability to say what is without concern.
It's being authentic. And being the same all the time. And what I mean by the same is being respectful, being clear, being truthful, without judgment. It's taking all those things and being that person, being that that is your authenticity, because you're not different one day and you're not one way one day and one way another day. You are the same person. You are respectful. You know, it's all those things about who you are and your integrity, your own values, that really, I think people see that. They feel it. I don't know that if that's all, though. I think there's more to it. I can remember the first time I heard someone in a SIG group, and I just resonated. I couldn't tell you right now everything they said, but maybe it was the tone of their voice. Maybe it was the ease, the calmness in which they knew their subject matter, what they had to say. But that authenticity, that honesty, that trust, it just resonated. It was there. I felt it. I responded to it, and I flew with it. It changed my life.
And see, I believe it doesn't always have to stay the same, but I think that what it does do is it honors who you are and then thus allows you to honor who others are as well.
And in that way, the thing that does stay the same is that it honors who you are.
Right.
And thereby it does. So what one might experience when one is saying what is, because it doesn't come from a place of ego, saying what is not about feeling like one is God. It is about saying what is from certainty about what that is, without attachment to it being certainty for others.
Yes.
So it's coming from that cellular level again.
Yes. Coming from that cellular level of ownership of this is how it is for me. And you can run with me or not. It's also why when I've, you know, and I've mentioned this, that when I've advocated that coaches, that anybody who's in the coaching profession at some point in their life have a coach, it's not about because you're walking your talk so much as it is about being able to say what the experience of coaching is from a place of truthful experience, which then becomes indisputable. Nobody gets to argue with me about the value of coaching. They may get to dispute whether or not it may be valuable for them, but that there is inherent value in the process, they don't get to argue because I know it from the inside out. I've experienced coaching and still do. So they don't get to go, yeah, coaching is bullshit. I'm sorry. I know better. And whether or not it fits someone else is a different question. But whether or not in and of itself it has merit and value, from my experience, absolutely. And for that point alone, I think it is valuable for anyone working in the coaching profession to have had or have a coaching experience. And I don't mean like a one-off session. No, that they've had it somewhere from some people in their life. And what that does is that it grounds it. So I can say what is about coaching easily. Any other places come to play with passion before we move on to our other topic for today? How does being able to say what is help you advocate your passion?
You don't second guess yourself. You just do it.
Yeah. And that is a huge point. Yes, go ahead.
And part of it also, for me, is that not trying to persuade anybody else. Like, this is my truth. Without that place of trying to grab on to someone else about it. Whether it should be yours too, or you should, you know, come along. I mean, none of that kind of stuff. So I appreciate that.
It's a desk.
As I was reading this too, it's open. I was a lawyer in a very long ago past life, and it's like, wow, this is just opposite of being a lawyer. That's what's my take on it. Just listen.
It's certainly clearly opposite of being a politician. Because usually for them, saying what is actually, it's the beginning of a phrase of saying, is saying what is most likely to get me elected.
Yeah.
Which brings me to the point of everything you hear, the news and so on and so forth, most everything is coming from a place that's opposite of this list. So the world is bombarded with the opposite of saying what is. And so, like, I can't remember who it was, BJ, or who said her experience of being around someone that spoke like this was just so powerful. Because for one thing, it's unique. That doesn't happen very often.
Yes.
And I would love to be able to speak from this list.
Well, that's actually part of our next slide.
I was setting you up.
And the next slide is key frictors to saying what is. And the frictors to subtract, the places to focus, are the frictors to subtract it, because it's actually our natural state. It's our natural state. How many times do you see someone shut a kid down for what it is that they're just saying that is their natural expression?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mommy, I have to go to the bathroom. Bursts into the living room at a tea party. Honey, you don't say that in polite company.
Mm-hmm.
A number of years ago, I was in a workshop, and a person who was in front of the room was sharing about an experience he had just of this kind of phenomenon. And he said he was over at his nephew's house. Nephew might have been 4. And it was a kind of dark time for him, and he was sitting there, and he's saying, and the little kid was looking at him, and he said, why are you so sad? And the guy, being a person who wanted to just be truthful with his kid, he says, I'm lost. I don't know where I am. And the little kid says to him, with just such beautiful acumen, he points to him sitting on the couch. He points to him and he says, mm-hmm. But you're right there. Oh, man. It's our natural state to say what is. And then we learn how not to, as Bert's alluded to. So the key frictors that go along with that, that are part of the pre-verbal conditioning, are hungers. These are hidden forces that compel us to feed our craving for emotional food. Another way to look at that is Maslow's needs. But the hungers for attention, recognition, power, control, love, acceptance, hungers to be wanted, valued, important, needed or noticed, hunger to feel safe, secure, stable, belonging, and connected. And so, of course, if it looks like that food is going to be deprived of us and we have a very strong hunger for it, we're not going to say what is. If we say what is, and then all of a sudden we're not going to feel wanted or be feel important or needed or even noticed, it's a high risk. Another frictor to saying what is, another group of the categories here, is the identifications. Being identified with the roles we play, the titles we have, the history of our family and ourself, and even the identification with our sense of self, meaning this is a who I am. And so if what we have to say is in conflict with any of that, you know, somebody, well, you're the president, you can't say that. You know, if you say that, you'll never be elected again.
Michael.
You know, if you say this in, yes, go ahead.
I would like to take the other side of this. I think there are some things in there that we do, but not for the reasons being a fritter. I mean, someone wants to be a doctor and becomes a doctor. They do it because they want to help humanity. But I also think somewhere in there, you know, there is some recognition for what they do. They want it. I mean, we all want those things. I don't think we so much as power and control, but everybody wants to be accepted and loved. It's a natural feeling when you're in a relationship. It might not be the entire gamut of your life or the main purpose, but at some point those emotions do play a part in a human being.
Well,
you know, being wanted,
this,
being valued.
Right.
You know, why does a woman go shopping and buy a dress and she wants the right shoes to go with it? She wants to please, you know, maybe her spouse, her partner, and she wants to look nice because maybe she's going to an important function. So it might not be direct, but there is a part of it there that is congruent with life.
It's congruent with the external messages we have from life. I would agree from that point of view.
Yeah,
so, for example, let's take a look at acceptance, okay? If we have a hunger for acceptance and we don't say what is, and listen, this all you have to do is look at a teenager's life in a high school, right? If they say what is and they have a hunger for acceptance, they'll be drummed out of the in crowd in a heartbeat. If the football guy, if the Mr. Popular has, you know, a touch of what one might call a conscience or heart, and he sees a bunch of people bullying somebody who is normally the what one might call the dork or the nerd or whatever, or the outcast, and he calls those people out, 99 times out of 100, he's no longer going to be Mr. Popular.
But I'm not saying I'm not arguing with that. My issue is that some of these things, whether it might not be as a teenager, it might not be as a young adult, but through life experiences, through relationships, through working relationships, there are some of these aspects of these words that do make us feel good. I mean, isn't it nicer when, if you're in a group situation, you're on a team in a corporate environment, and you work together with people, and you know, and they recognize, you know, the strides you're making, and you're doing it for them, and that recognition that you get. Everybody likes to feel good and know that people are there with you, supporting you. I'm not saying that your life is based on that, and that if you live for that only, then that's not what we're talking about. But I'm saying there are facets of it that I think are involved in. You know, when your children come to you and they say, "I love you," you know, "Thank you, Mom," or "Thank you, Dad," or they're giving you recognition for being a great parent. Who doesn't like that? But is that going to make me go out and say, you know, and live on those words? No. But it's still a nice feeling at the time that it happens.
And it's an especially nice feeling if, yes, I do. It's an especially nice feeling if you're not hungry for it.
Yes, if it comes without any agenda.
Right, well, and that's
exactly
identifies, and I would say, especially with the identification component of it, Molly, that was something that I'm having to do some self-exploration with for myself, and I think that that's why I say that living from that place of authenticity, it can change. It's not as, while yes, you honor yourself, and that component of it is steadfast and consistent, how you honor yourself changes.
Yes. Yes. And Michael,
I expect
that it deepens.
The way I'm seeing this is, number one, I don't have any particular problems with identifications and fears. I'm kind of past that. But what I hear her saying is that all of this is natural, and it's going to be going on. No matter what the heck is going on in our life, it's just still going to be a subtext. But what I see you saying here is, if this subtext is driving your communication, then it's an issue. Not that.
Absolutely.
It's
yes. So it's not that a hunger for attention is the problem per se. It is how we get that fed and what we will do, or what we're willing to do or not do, in order to get that fed.
Right.
It's not that acceptance is a problem. It's not that being valued is a problem. It's not that experiencing a moment of being recognized is a problem. It's that the hunger for that will drive us to not say what is, out of fear that we won't get it fed.
I wanted to make that distinction. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, cool. And thank you, Bert. That was a nice clarification as well. So distinctions, clarifications. Fabulous. And the third one on the list was a fear of future consequences, such as someone else. This is one of the reasons why we don't say what is. Someone else will be upset, or we won't be liked, or we'll be ostracized and ultimately left alone, which will feel like our survival is at stake. And so I know personally that there are any number of places where my saying what is has cost me a belonging in a certain group. Now, if I were attached to belonging to that group, this would be a problem. However, it's the question for me has been, in recent years, has been, would I want to belong to a group where I couldn't say what is for me, regardless of what the advantages of that group looks like? Would I want to live my life partially stifling myself? Or would I rather say what is for me, and then see who is attracted to that and let the group self-create, wherein we can all have that kind of way of speaking? For example, Bert, you spoke what was for you. Molly, you just spoke what was for you. You're all doing that on this call. And so when you presence the absence of a volume of fringers, it starts to become the space around you where you say what is and others do as well. And so one of the fears that we have of being ostracized by saying what is actually starts to be shown to be an illusion, or that it was an illusion, because we have actually found a better group, a group that says you can say what is. In the meantime, it's very useful to think of something, and this will be an experiment that I invite you all to play in this week, to think of something that you have wanted to say to someone but have been reluctant to say. I'm not saying to go say it. What I'm saying is to use that prompt of considering saying it to provoke inside you the energy of what needs to be resolved about that. And once it's resolved, then see whether or not it's appropriate to say it.
Michael, if I went down that list of clear, clean, kindly, truthful, and so forth, right? If I'm coming from there, if I'm coming from there, automatically these frictors are not involved for me. If I could possibly come from there, what couldn't you say in any circumstance?
Exactly. However, there's a challenge in the notion of attempting to come from there and override any of the potential background programs that are running, and it's simpler to simply subtract the frictors, and then all of that list is a natural come from. You don't have to remember it. You don't have to remind yourself to it. You don't have to amp up your energy to do that. You don't have to process yourself in the moment about it. It's just where you come from.
I think we call that mastery.
Yep. Yep. And for me, personally, one of the prime avenues to mastery, as I see it, is subtraction. Because all we're doing is peeling away the accumulated layers of crap that have overlaid our essence of magnificence. Stuff we have either consciously or unconsciously, deliberately or inadvertently taken on over the course of our lives.
One of the things that happened for me, you know, I kept like getting to that place of, oh yeah, I'm one with the universe. It's like remembering. That was a word that was really important for me, remembering I'm one with the universe. And once I'm there, then it's easy. It's just that place of, and that's what I'm hearing too. It's getting to that place of remembering who we really are by subtracting
right. What
we're not. It's gotten added on to us from all kinds of places.
And what happens, what do you think will happen if you subtract any of the things that keep you from naturally knowing so that you actually don't have to engage in the activity called remembering?
Thanks.
You get the sense of that as I say that?
I'm getting a sense of, oh, yeah, that's another place that it felt like, I get a sense.
Yeah. It frees you to like, just being.
It's like I don't have to remember if I just am.
Yes. Do you have to actually, at this moment in time, remember to breathe?
Yeah. Yes.
No.
Sometimes.
You just breathe. Well, only when it's challenged. Only when it's significantly challenged. But I know people talk about remembering to breathe from, like, breathing deeply and all that sort of stuff or in a yogic fashion or New Age fashion, whatever it is. Guess what? Yeah, you're breathing right now, whether you remember to or not.
Right.
It's the natural state. Think of it like breathing. What if coming from your essence was like breathing? What if coming from your magnificence, from as Bert outlined, coming from that list was like breathing? You didn't have to set up a Google 10-minute reminder. You didn't have to set your watch to go off to remind you to be spontaneous. Oh, yes, it's time for me to be spontaneous now. That's what subtraction can do.
Mm-hmm.
So here's, let's say, and this is just, the next slide up is just a reminder of the tools for subtraction. A demo I don't think is available today. Doesn't seem like it. So here's what to call with respect to desire. Desire is synonymous with and yet distinct from. And I want to ask you all to feel into the difference in these words as I speak them. Okay? Want, which by definition means lack. often, although not always, it's a heady thing. I want $1 million. I want a job. I want a promotion. I want more business. I want, et cetera. Wish, which is a fantasy. When you wish upon a star. And it's an abdication of participation. But more than the definitions, feel into the energy. Need, which is the illusion of not being whole. Hope for, which is one would like to have it happen, but they're not committed to any action that's called for. Desire. It's deep, compelling, and it is the coals of the fire that is expressed as passion. So listen to these words again. Want, wish, need, hope for, desire. And just feel their energy different. Your desire is what you want for the world, for others, for yourself. And it's expressed in a passionate way. So before I go into the comparison trap, I just want to ask you, a couple of you, what clicked or hit for you about the distinction of that, of those words?
What comes up for me is, you know, the want and the need and the hope for are like contraction type of words. As opposed to like just desire is more of an expansive type of concept.
That's interesting. So the energy you felt was contraction versus expansion.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now mine was similar. Want, wish, need, and hope for I saw as black and white, and desire I saw as technicolor.
Yeah, I get that as you speak it.
For me, I think it was want, hope, wish, need. Those are all things that you have to work for or work towards, whereas desire is something that you're drawn towards.
Yes. Most of the you know, the four horsemen there, most of them are extrinsic. And desire is within. While it may feel like I want something is from within, it is something outside me. Desire is about my expression. Most of the rest of those are about my acquisition. Just some thoughts to play with. So I'm going to talk about the comparison trap here for a minute. And the comparison trap, I got this from an Aussie picture, chalk and cheese. That's the way they say it. In the States, we call it oil and water. They say it's chalk and cheese. And with a picture of chalk and cheese next to each other, you can really get how different they are. You would not want to eat one, and you certainly wouldn't want to draw with the other. So... But the comparison trap is a misperception of our uniqueness. When we live in comparison, it means we are not grounded thoroughly in our uniqueness because there is no comparison in our uniqueness. And comparison leads to a constant win-lose experience. On any given day, I'm better than or worse than, contingent on who I encounter. My business is better than or worse than. I am a better than coach or a worse than coach. I can ask questions better than or worse than. I listen better than or worse than. You know, any of that stuff. You know, my life is better than or worse than. On any given day, depending on how we're feeling on an emotional level, which sometimes has to do with simple chemicals and hormones, we're going to come out on one side or the other of that particular experience. And the only way to not have that kind of roller coaster is to not play the game of comparison. It's a win, lose, flip the coin game. If one is grounded and lives from the uniqueness, you're not worried about what somebody else has or doesn't have, can do or can't do, is or isn't. Your focus is on the expression of the uniqueness of you. It's a game no one can beat you at because they can't even play. They can't play you better than you. You'll get points on subtlety and nuance that they can't even begin to. Comparison trap occurs when people attempt to measure themselves against the circumstantial evidence of another. On any given day, that'll look either bad or good. The key is to simply honor one's uniqueness, passion, desire as their own, and therefore already of value without comparison. You're not valuable compared to someone else. You are valuable simply because you are, and there's only one of you. Parfume de Desire. Here's our distilled essence picture. So, the last slide here is remember always, and once again, always meaning all the time, and always meaning in all ways, the client that you're working with, intersecting with, is filled with deep desires that are honored when we call them forth to be experienced. When they are connected with their desires, that desire in that moment is honored. It doesn't mean that it's not there. It absolutely is already there. And it's a connection that is at some percentage at any given point in time. And if we can support people in connecting with those true, deep desires, and move the frequency up from, say, 50% connection to 75 to even 51. But if we can get them deeply connected to their desire, we have really served well. And if we don't, then it perhaps wasn't for us to do. So, the field work this week is to see what frictors there are between you and saying what is. And look around your world and see who the most inflammatory comparisons are in your life. When I say inflammatory, what I mean is the ones that really chafe you when you make that comparison. And you either feel really, yee-haw, look at me, or you're feeling like really bad and self-recriminating and, geez, I should be there by now, look at them. You know, look how young they are and they have this, or look how hot they are, or look how intelligent they are, look how, whatever it is, the comparison is that has you feeling less. And then provoke that and go to the energy either inside, if it's an incomplete experience, or it's outside, meaning you have this expectation that you are supposed to be somehow better than, or wiser than, or more enlightened than, or whatever the than is, which is really ironic, you know, for anybody to assert that they're more enlightened than anybody else. The minute you do that, your ego is running all over your enlightenment. Mm-hmm. I am more enlightened than he. How silly is that? Like, I have more cosmic knowledge than he. And the moment I articulate it that way, I have sunk down, if I wanted to compare it, to below, to being obsessed with my ego. So just check. Check and see which comparisons chafe you, and then do something about it. Let go of the expectation that you are either better than or supposed to be better than, or you're worse than, and you are somehow lacking in something intrinsic, like I am intrinsically flawed, and address that and go to town with it. So, here at the close, what, if anything, is there for you to say so that you can feel complete?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for your participation today.
Damn you, Michael, for making me look at that word, remember.
You're welcome.
Good response.
I want to know about that hunk of burning love. We didn't explore that.
The hunk of burning desire?
Yeah.
That's
where,
what's
where's
left.
That coming up? We overlooked that one.
The hunk of burning desire is what's left when all the frictors have been around desire have been subtracted.
Oh, I thought it was all the boyfriends I've had in my past.
No. That's just a Chippendale. That's just a Chippendales video.
Ah. Okay. That's a letdown.
You know, something that I saw today on the news, speaking of news, was there was something with Michelle Obama yesterday, and a heckler. And she went up to that heckler and said, you know, I'm not going to take this, and it's either you or it's me. And, you know, audience, you decide who you want. So it's like, you know, she spoke what is, and, of course, it's taking crap today from the right wing. But it's just that, you know, it's just, it seemed to go with this so well. To me, that was a really good modeling of saying what is and not caring what anybody thought about it.
Yeah, she was just going to say, this is how it is. I'm not going to do this.
Yeah.
So either take the mic, you know, and she said what is.
Mm-hmm.
And the other person actually said what was for her. Later, she says, she came right up in my face, and I didn't expect that. And that was an absolutely truthful reporting of what was for her.
Mm-hmm.
She you know, my imagination is that she hoped that she could be, you know, like anonymous in the crowd, or, you know, as his voice, or, you know, whatever it was. But nevertheless, she got her attention. Not in the way that she wanted, but she got her attention. So anything else for you to complete today for anyone?
I kind of think that what Bert said about mastery is kind of the key to when I spoke about the person that I listened to in the SIG group. It was the mastery of that human being, I think, that really was part of the connection that I had. It wasn't only the, because I really don't know what that word is. I'm still searching in my mind. But I think it was mastery. That was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a confidence, maybe.
Well, it's an absence of concern for people's opinions about it as well.
So that's authentic.
One's going to speak it and speak what's there. And the mastery isn't about the mastery of speaking. As Bert alluded to, it is self-mastery that says one has taken the time to absence as many of the things that would keep one from simply saying what is. So mastery is a word that we put on an experience that we have from someone. We tend to think it's in the activity, but it's actually not. Mastery is in what that person has had to go through.
It's in their core.
In order, yes. And it's what they've had to go through to in order for them to show up speaking masterfully. Self-mastery leads to masterful. So there are people who have mastery who haven't studied communication techniques as part of their background or program. And yet they have mastery simply because of who they've become. So having any fun yet, y'all?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Good. I'll be really curious to hear what happens when you go start knocking down the comparison. Mm-hmm. That'll be fun. And what the most irritating comparison is, you know? Now, see, you know, the interesting thing about that is that that has become really absent in my life in many, many ways. I'm sure there are probably some places where I'm still agitated by it. But when I listen to, at times, a coach masterfully coaching, I don't compare myself to them. I just go, wow, that's freaking brilliant. And I just go, that's great. Would I have done it that way? Hell no. Do I appreciate the way they did it? Absolutely.
But that's because you're so many years down the road. If you take someone like myself who's 2 years down the road, I think it's a natural way of thinking, you know. I still go, wow, you know, it is brilliant, because it is. And the comparison is not, I mean, it was a while ago I wanted to be that way, but I know I can. I can only be me. But I can,
yes.
But I can have the desire to increase whatever I have to make it even better.
Yes, that's the place. If one is going to compare, it's only useful as a calibration tool of self to self. Have I moved from where I was? So the only comparison is me to me. But not for so that I feel like I am better than the old me, but so that I can witness
right.
the movement. Uh-huh. I love a phrase, and again, you know, you all know that I've been to any number of transformational type whoop-de-doos, and many of which didn't really do it for me. But there was one thing that I found really amusing, and it was many, many, many years ago in Madison Square Garden, and Werner Erhard was speaking. And he says, you know, I look back at myself 2 years ago. He says, and I have the realization, the shocking realization, that I wonder how anybody that ignorant, unconscious, and self-absorbed could simply live on the planet. And he says, and in this moment in time, I have the awareness that it's possible that 2 years from now, I'm going to be looking back at this moment with a similar recognition. And I just went, yes. You know, one can judge oneself from being there, or one can just go, wow, I've moved. But does that mean I have arrived? No, it just means I've moved. And we're all so quick to try and arrive. We want to get to that ultimate state. I just want to keep moving. And with that being said, let's keep moving on with our day and our evening, wherever you are. And let's connect with you all next week.
Okay. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Michael.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.